Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Here we go. So, our first question today, if I get back here again, is we are 4.5 months from discovery and disclosure. My husband says he wants to work on the marriage, but is definitely being ambivalent about it. He was the unfaithful one. At times, I question if he's doing all he can do. And he responds with, "Do you want to see me not trying?" I question it because I don't see him doing all the homeworks or even wanting to do some of them. We rarely talk about the affair or how we need to proceed. When things are brought up, he wonders how he can be happy with me and how his love and emotions will come back. We do have a counselor in America. We are currently overseas, and we have had a few sessions over the phone. My husband seems to be doing these sessions because of me, not because he wants to. I don't understand how he can say he's committed to me and the marriage, but doesn't do the things that would help me feel safe. For example, he's been gone for 3 weeks on business and rarely contacted me, only when I made the first move. Shouldn't he be checking in daily and giving me updates just so I can feel secure? I don't even know how to bring this topic up since he gets defensive and says he can't ever be good enough for me. This isn't the case, by the way. I just want or need some reassurance from him, and he doesn't want to give it unless he feels he can. But shouldn't he do it for me anyway? Another issue here is there's a baby in the picture. He hasn't seen the child yet, but he stated he wants to go without me, alone. I said I can't do that. I can't let him go alone and feel that if our marriage is to move forward, I should be the one to go with him. I can't trust him to see his AP alone, and two, I don't think they should be bonding over this. Thankfully, our counselor is on the same page with me on this one. My husband's coming around to realizing that though this isn't practical, it is needed for us to go on together. The problem is that he doesn't want to talk about it with me unless he can picture it in his mind. He's wigged out at the prospect of seeing me and his AP in the same room, and that overshadowing his time with his son. Can you give me any practical ways that we can make this happen in the least awkward way? I don't want to see his AP ever again, but I want to move forward in our marriage and realize this child will always be a part of it. I want to bond with my husband through his pain. I want to learn to love this child as much as he does. But how do I get him, husband, to let me do this? How can I approach both of these topics with him? I don't want to come across nagging, but I want to be able to bring up subjects so we can talk and move forward. I'm totally at a loss. So one of the things you want to be able to do, I think, one of the goals of recovery is just being able to have that rational conversation instead of an emotional conversation. And sometimes one of the things that is really helpful is to ask the question, you know, can we have that sort of rational conversation? And kind of challenge it on the front end. Say, you know, I'd like to be able to talk with you about some things, but I'd really like to see if we could just be very calm and rational about it and not emotional and look at it from like a 30,000-foot level rather than trying to even solve all of it. A good place to start, as funny as this may sound, is just trying to understand each other's perspective. See if he's willing to listen to your perspective. And I would start first by asking him kind of what, again, his concerns are. The more you talk about it and the more he can express how he feels about it, and the more you're able to listen to him and not be defensive, but in fact, it's almost like you want to be able to do nothing as he's talking about kind of his feelings about the whole thing, other than just listen and hear what he has to say. Model for him that ability to stay calm and cool, keeping it rational, and then in turn say, you know, would you like me to be, and talk not about him, blame him for anything, but instead just talk about how you feel about it and what your perspective is, and ultimately help him to understand your perception in the same way that you try to understand his perception. Couples that, you know, one of the growth points for couples is being able to differentiate. It's almost like being able to see, are both of you have different points of view and yet kind of maintain your own sense of hanging on to your own values and what's important to you, even though there are differences. I mean, that's just, that's called conflict intimacy. It's the ability to have that conflict or that difference, but you've differentiated enough that it's not like you feel like you're, you know, somebody's got to compromise themselves. It's how do we sit with the difference? Because some things aren't going to be solved easily. And your ability to be safe while he talks about it probably is a place for him, at least, to begin to help get his mind around what it might look like. Because if you can't be safe just while the two of you talk about it, then it's going to be really difficult for him to believe farther down the line, if you're actually there, that things would go well. So the conversation to me would be kind of the first thing. The other thing I would say, though, is, you know, one of the things that, you know, is really, you know, you're bringing up one thing here that's a bit of a concern to me, because your questions of shouldn't he be willing to call me or stay in touch with me? I mean, you need, and I think marriages need, I guess, an understanding or at least a sense that their mate ultimately is really committed to the process, and that in the long run that they're earnest about moving forward with the relationship. If you're not able to determine like this kind of earnestness, their willingness to go forward with the relationship, it's really hard, I think, for you to, I think, be comfortable in this thing. It sounds like, you know, as you said, there's a great deal of ambivalence on his part. And, you know, that's... it's just a concern. I would hope that he's going to be earnest, because ultimately that earnestness to me would look like there would certainly be some expression of regret and remorse. There would certainly be those behaviors that are trust building, and that there would be the involvement in therapy. It sounds like he's got the involvement in therapy. That's really good. And it sounds like he's even compromised to some extent. But I would want to work out, how do we maintain contact? Because if you're not being able to communicate over long periods of time while he's traveling, or you don't know how to connect during those time periods, to me that just creates a concern in the sense that you may continually drift apart. Another thing that, just a suggestion, well, that's probably enough for that particular question, because I see you've got another one up here. Let's see if we've got a question here on that. Hang on just a second. Okay, second question is on ambivalence. We've been told by our counselor that we have trouble communicating. No surprise there. He tells us things to work on, and I want to work on them, but my husband isn't doing it so much. He's having trouble, at least I think he is, letting go of his emotions for his affair partner. I noticed at times that he's having a bad day, and if he's having a bad day, I'll ask about it, but he doesn't want to share it with me. He says nothing is wrong. or you don't want to hear that. Well, in my huge insecurities these days, this makes me worry. From there, I ask him if it's anything I need to worry about or anything he plans on acting on or if he's just working through stuff. He replies, I don't know. Ugh. How do I get him to start communicating with me? We don't talk about the affair or our recovery much at all. When I bring stuff up, he tends to start to shut down. I don't always ask about his feelings because if I do, tell him when things bother me or if I need reassurance or comfort from him. I don't always ask about his feelings because of this, but I do tell him when things bother me or if I need reassurance or comfort from him. Even when I express my issues, he doesn't reply with reassurance. I need or more than an okay, or I can see how you feel like that. I worry that his not talking about this stuff with me and keeping it inside will drive him to her. I know his emotions and feelings aren't with me right now, at least the warm and fuzzy ones. That makes our lack of communication worry me more. What do I do? How do I get him to talk and share with me? Are his feelings normal for this point of recovery after an emotional affair? Are these feelings part of his grieving? And it doesn't make anything better that he's been out of town the past 2 weeks and has to leave again for 1.5 weeks. He talks to me rarely when he's gone and wants to put it out of his mind. I can understand, but it makes me crazy. You know, again, part of the problem is his ability, I would suspect, to process with you kind of what's going on through all of this would be, I can see how that might be difficult. My question would be, and it sounds like you've got a counselor, is he doing any individual counseling to kind of address this issue, or is he involved with any type of coach or men's group or other people that he can talk to and process with? I know that when I work with men's groups, a lot of times what I will end up doing is having them do what I call a self-awareness exercise. Because guys, honestly, and some women too, it's difficult to begin to develop intimacy if you don't have a self-intimacy, if you don't have awareness of really how you're feeling, if the way that you deal with things, as we men frequently do, is compartmentalization rather than becoming self-aware and kind of learning how to take care of yourself. And I think if without that awareness, then the probabilities of using alcohol or, you know, other means, affair partners to mood alter or just to self-soothe or just to kind of deal with life go up pretty significantly. So, you know, if he's involved, I mean, if he would be involved potentially with some sort of coach, if he would be involved with some sort of counseling, I think that would be really important. Even for your counselor to give you some very simple intimacy exercises with rituals of doing things and checking in just on a daily basis. And those check-ins don't have to be really heavy, something that your husband would necessarily dread. It can be as simple as a feeling that I've had today and another time in my life when I had that same feeling. But it's And it really is feeling-based. It's how do I get back to the place where I become aware kind of what's going on in the emotional realm, not just in the intellectual realm. Now, the other thing I can imagine is that, you know, if this he may be a little scared of even going there at one level just because of the pain he may be feeling as a result of what's occurred as the affair. And learning how to grieve and deal with that could be a really hard thing. Again, if he can be with other men, I think you could help him process through that. It would be really useful. And again, having the therapist potentially prescribe those daily events may be a simple way to get him to begin communicating with you again and provide a way for that to happen. And I would certainly think maintaining that contact and continuing to find ways to actually have fun, even if you're doing simple things that are fun, like Internet Scrabble, games that you can play over the cell phone. Try to find ways to connect that don't require just talking about heavy stuff, but ways the two of you can have fun even while he's traveling. And then I'm thinking sometimes internet games or things like that can be a really fun way for the two of you to continue to connect. So also try to build something like that in so there's a sense of connection, but it's not all, you know, it takes away maybe his dread of it's going to be heavy and difficult. But he begins to look forward to kind of the games and things that the two of you get to do together. It brings play into the process. Certainly think that could be a useful tact. So the next question, miserable marriage. Sorry, Rick, this idea of marriage intentionally needing to be miserable just doesn't work for me. I have too many years, 21, of feeling that way. Not the whole time, mind you, but for too much of it. So every time I have to do an exercise that involves this concept or homework, it acts like a huge trigger, not helping me move the right direction. I know there's some tongue-in-cheek in this, but really it does send me down the wrong path. What to do? Okay, so I really don't think, obviously, that marriage is totally intended to make us miserable. All I am trying to say is, you got it, in the tongue-in-cheek, is you want to pursue the right things in marriage. And one of the things that couples have to be able to do, there are four stages that marriages go through. There's the initial honeymoon stage, and that's just everything's good and gold and wonderful, and we, you know, are gaga, and we can't believe I'm married to you. All of that stage ends. And we go to the conflict stage of marriage. And in the conflict stage of marriage, a lot of times, if we're on kind of an enmeshed path where we're looking for our mate to meet our needs, ultimately that makes us miserable. The whole point of the conflict stage of marriage ultimately is to develop, and this is called conflict intimacy, but it's the ability to learn how to see our mate and both of us be very different and still be differentiated in the process, still have our own points of view, our own intimacy, have our differences, vive la différence, but still maintain connection. That is a huge growth point for couples. The third stage, by the way, is the growth stage, and the fourth stage is the union stage. Many couples don't even reach the union stage. A lot of couples never get past the conflict stage because they continue looking to their mate to be the solution to their problem. To move beyond that, you really do start with what I would call almost like that self-intimacy, that ability, each of you, of becoming very self-aware of kind of who you are, what your feelings are, what's important, and then you begin practicing in, you know, how do we sit together kind of knee to knee, eye to eye, you know, me and me, you and me, and talk and just understand the other person's perception and begin to, even when they're different than us, be able to figure out, how do I calm down and still love you and still be with you, still connect with you, still appreciate you. And because, again, two-thirds of all problems are going to be unsolvable. The thing that's really good about John Gottman's work and that whole approach is it really looks about how do we begin to develop positive habits, ways of doing the relationship where, in spite of the differences, we can still feel that appreciation and we can still feel love. We don't have to be the same. Because I promise you, in a marriage, as I do the tongue-in-cheek piece, if it's about us having to see things the same way, if we continue to bludgeon each other trying to get the other person to change, or if it's about this enmeshment where we feel like we've got to compromise who God made us to be in order to just appear close, then eventually what's going to occur in that relationship is, A, you're either going to begin to look beyond the relationship because you're too miserable and there's too much negative emotion that's stuffed down just because the two of us are tied together. And guys, when you've got a bunch of feelings that haven't been able to be processed and you can't sit there and talk about it and you're unaware of it, it's like you know, ultimately that emotion creates emotion towards some sort of action that's not going to be helpful, some sort of that negative emotion. And so just being able to learn to be honest and transparent with how you feel with the other person, talking, communicating. And in the Married for Life program, we actually talk about that. How do you begin to know how the other person's feeling, and how do you know that the other person still cares? And we give exercises to help move beyond that or develop that conflict intimacy. Because on the other side of conflict intimacy, you get to the really good stuff, which would be things like, you know, the affection intimacy. Those would be intimacies like physical intimacy, spiritual intimacy, intellectual intimacy. And you want to be able to also share in those things and not just have the conflict or the differences in the relationship drive you apart. So, you know, I hope that gives a little bit of an explanation. So all I'm really trying to do with the whole thing of marriage making you miserable is just go, okay, quit trying in the long run to think as it about being, or think about it being the other person meeting the needs. Learn how to stand on your own two feet, to have your own sense of self. And from that place, again, it's not a matter of how well you can get your mate to meet your needs, or how well you meet your mate's needs. It's ultimately about how well can you love God, love others, and love self. How well can you still be real and be authentic in that relationship, even when there's a difference, and still care about the other person, and calm down and learn. And you won't solve everything, but if you can learn to sit with that, you also have the ability to experience the other pieces of intimacy and still maintain open levels of communication, and it causes a tremendous amount of growth when you come to that place. So the next question, compulsions. You explained to me that sexual addiction consists of compulsions that are unmanageable. The addict essentially doesn't have a choice whether to act out or not. My husband claims he tried to stop acting out and he didn't want to do it. He says that there were times that he had the opportunity to act out, but he made up excuses as to why he could not meet the person. If there was never a choice or contemplative thinking, how was he able to turn down the opportunity sometimes but not others? Okay, so the thing about the compulsion, like with the poison ivy example I've used before in the past, with that compulsion, it's like, it's whether or not I take the first drink. It's not, I do have a point of choice. It's not that I'm powerless. I'm powerless once I begin. I have a choice as to whether or not I start. And so, you know, the alcoholic, and that's why we say, you know, one drink is too many, 20 is not enough. The thing is, the point of choice, that first drink may be amazingly tempting, but if, because of health, because of a good support system, because of learning how to look at life differently, learning how to live life on life's terms, learning how to participate with God in the process, you know, I can get to the point where I don't have to pick up the first drink. I can get to the point where I don't have to engage. To me, when someone makes excuses, doesn't hook up with someone, they didn't pick up the first drink. They were tempted to pick up the first drink, and any alcoholic would be tempted to pick up the first drink. I mean, they didn't start the process. I can promise you, though, once they start the process and make the seemingly unimportant decisions necessary to kind of put themselves there, and then things begin to happen, that's when they lose control. So the next question, confused. My husband ended up moving in with the girl he's having an affair with, but comes crying to me that he knows that what he's doing is wrong and can't stop it. The affair came from a sexual addiction that turned into a love addiction. We're both Christians. Obviously, he's been living in sin for a long time, and I didn't know it. I think he thinks I'm now too good for him, and this other woman is what he deserves. He can't handle the guilt and pain, so he just stays in this relationship. I feel like there is nothing that I can do anymore. Is there anything? If he isn't willing to work on our marriage, then isn't the only option divorce? You know, and that is so sad when someone comes to the place, by the way, where they feel like they, you know, someone else is too good for them. I mean, the fact is, shame has so gotten them at this point. You know, the one thing I would say is you can give him the message over and over again, reminding him that it's not about grace, that he has choices, and I would certainly give him those particular messages. But I would agree that when, I mean, to me, the biggest deal breaker of all is when the other person isn't willing to do what is necessary to address the issue. There's always hope as long as somebody is willing to do something. There's always hope, you know, as long as they will just address it. But when they won't, even begin to do that, at that point, you know, it just feels to me that you're right. You need to just, I mean, as sad as this all sounds, I mean, that is the one thing. You've got to, you may be the one that has to move on. And hopefully, someday he'll get out of his own, you know, whatever is going on with him. I mean, but again, if he's not willing to own his part of the problem, to do what's necessary, and he's unwilling to commit to trying his or her best to overcome the issue, that to me is the deal breaker. And so, yeah, I would say moving on. I don't know what else to tell you, because you can't make somebody do treatment. And I'm terribly sorry that he made that choice. But that would certainly be one of the indicators. And but again, you can still speak grace to him. You can still speak love to him. But I would also be very clear with him and say, you know, I'm moving on. And another thing you might want to do in a situation like this is read the old book that James Dobson wrote, Love Must Be Tough. He does a really nice job of how to lay that out, what to do, things to say. I think you would find it very, very useful in that process. Let's see. We'll get right back here. Next question. How to love an unfaithful, undeserving spouse? How can a hurt spouse show their pain and anger without using Scripture as a weapon to prove an active, unfaithful spouse is messed up and living a life that will absolutely lead to pain, misery while alive on this earth? Why do some people take that approach of bludgeoning their mate with Scripture? Isn't it obvious we all are sinners before the eyes of God every day, every minute, for our entire life? And this approach can't convict anyone, an unfaithful spouse or anyone else, but only pushes them farther away, correct? Do you believe that an active unfaithful spouse can die and still be united with God? I thought that was the entire point of God's grace. We're never not sinning. We always need to know that we need God's grace. Actually, I would agree with you. You know, I don't know. I think at times being able to confront someone and let them know that what they're doing is incredibly harmful, damaging to themselves, damaging to others. You know, that is, you know, I certainly out of love, want to say that to people. I tend to ask questions a lot more, saying, you know, what are you thinking? How, not in the sense of what are you thinking, but how do you see this working out? What are you hoping? What do you believe? And people are usually a lot more open to answering questions and exploring. And if you can find out kind of where their problems are, where their struggles are, we can have a dialogue. I think when you're talking at someone, it's much more difficult to have a dialogue, you know, if they'll have a conversation. I mean, certainly there are times for interventions. But again, I think the truth is always spoken in love. And even Jesus taught totally that mercy triumphs over judgment. It's not a judgmental thing. And you're right in your point that all people sin. In fact, I believe that people, you've heard me say this before, they don't go to hell for sin. People go to hell for pride because they just want to admit and accept their problems. They won't admit and accept what they can't do. They won't admit and accept that, you know, they need another way because the way they're doing it doesn't work. And, you know, a lot of times when I have someone that's kind of hell-bent on going the wrong direction, I mean, to me, it isn't always about stopping them. I don't know ultimately what is going to be good or bad for them. You know, I try to warn them that there's a bridge out ahead, and, you know, I try to get them to think their way through it, encourage them. I tell them that, you know, I don't think this path ends up any place good, in my opinion. I ask them why they think this will work. I ask them if they've tried this path before and if it's worked before in the past. I remember a gentleman I worked with years ago, and he had come in from out of state. And as we started, he said, "You know, I'm an atheist, right?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I know, you know that I am a Christ follower. I mean, I actually am a Christian, but, you know, operate from a faith perspective." And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, we're good then. There's no problem." And I said, but I do have a question. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, my son and I have been talking about scientific methodology lately, and we've got kind of an argument going." And he said, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "Well, could you explain it to me?" And he said, "Well, it's where, you know, there's, you make an observation, you develop a hypothesis, you run a test to test that hypothesis, you evaluate whether or not it was true." And I said, well, here's our argument. How many times does that test have to fail before you disprove the hypothesis?" And he said, "Well, you know, it only has to fail one time." And I said, "Well, then I'm just really confused." And he said, "About what?" And I said, "Well, from the story you were telling me a while ago, you've run this same hypothesis in your life four times already, and it's failed every time. I mean, for the sake of scientific, you know, integrity, since you're a scientist here, I mean, how many more times do you have to run the hypothesis before you finally admit that maybe the way you're doing it doesn't work and you need to consider something different?" And he just kind of laughed, and he said, "That was pretty good." He said, didn't see that one coming. He said, "You know, honestly," he said, "you're right, but I still feel like I need to keep running that hypothesis." And I said, "Well, I understand that, but at some point, you know, would you consider that maybe the hypothesis doesn't work?" And to me, if you don't approach people with dignity and honor, then and literally the dignity, I think, afforded by the fact that they're God's children. And because the one thing this guy knew is I was deeply concerned about him and I cared about him. And I think sometimes, you know, if you go in and start trying to bludgeon people with scriptures or telling them what they need to do, if you try to guilt them, it's almost like they do it for the wrong reason. If they do it out of guilt, even if they do it, you know, I think guilt and pain can only sustain us for so long before eventually it wears off and we go back to maybe another way. So, or the old way. And so hopefully they'll be able to extend grace because, you know, if I look at scriptures like 1 Corinthians 3, if you look at it from a kind of a biblical perspective, it's not so much a matter. I know that I, you know, from my theological perspective, I'm saved by faith, not by my works. 1 Corinthians 3 would say, kind of my rewards in heaven are determined more about how I live after that point. You know, who am I really living for? And who am I? But it's not a matter of my salvation. But I'll never be free from, I guess, the things that capture me in this life until I can finally give up on thinking that I can do it, that I can control. I've got to find, and it sounds like, you know, these people you're talking about need to find another way. And I think, you know, there are other ways to get there. So hopefully that helps a little. Let's see. Whoops. Next question here. Let's see. I've been doing some emotional awareness exercises, and I'm starting to feel my good feelings a little. When my spouse kissed me yesterday, I could feel a little something in my body that was kind of nice. Why does emotional awareness, especially negative ones, impact my ability to feel my positive emotions? Will this continue to get better? I mean, will I start to have stronger feelings with my good feelings? I was so happy to feel something. I do love my spouse so much, and he's been very patient with me since we started, since I stopped feeling an interest in sex. Why did I feel my sexual drive so strongly for the first few months after I found out my spouse's affair and sexual addiction? Then it just vanished. Is this the jet fuel example, that I need jet fuel to feel usually, but I'm learning how to feel in a balanced range? So, by the way, way to go on doing the emotional awareness exercises. Proud of you for that. So, you know, I think we go through different stages of life where sometimes things are more painful than others. And I don't know that I always get to have the same level of bad feelings or the same level of good feelings. If you've never really even been aware of your feelings, you may not even be that aware of what have been the ups and downs of the feelings. I mean, I know for many of us, you know, especially those who have been addicts, you know, you're pretty doggone numb to feelings to begin with. And I think that what you're describing about the first part, sometimes intimacy, that there's almost like a honeymoon stage, even after an affair, a pink cloud, somebody referred to me once. We were telling him how great everything was in the marriage, and he says, oh, you're back on the pink cloud. And I said, well, how long does that last? And he said, it just depends. And it's almost like kind of a, we almost lost something that is incredibly special to us, and we're the chosen one, and everything is great. And so there's lots of motivations, because we are always motivated when we want what we don't have, or, you know, we were afraid we were going to lose something, and we're just, you know, excited to still have it. But then the hurt of what occurred actually begins to come in. Sometimes it's almost, Stephanie, my wife, described it almost like that initial phase of trying to reclaim what was hers and just kind of celebrating that she had that. And then she came to the next phase, which was she wanted, you know, now she's upset with me because all of the feelings about what I had done began to really sink in. And so that may be part of what's happening. I just don't know. But so I don't know that it's necessarily the jet fuel example. Now, as we grow in intimacy, however, and we deal with that, kind of learning the different parts of intimacy and finding desire once again, it's almost like you've got to begin to be more aware of yourself, I think, to begin to be able to learn how to connect. So I don't know that you've ever been that good at, you know, or many of us aren't that aware of what goes on within us. If you'll focus on those really positive feelings when there is a kiss, and you can find those, and you allow yourself to experience those rather than, you know, kind of disqualifying those or ignoring those, eventually you'll begin to find that passion begins to grow. I heard an analogy once that I thought was really great by one of our mentor couples. And he said, you know, that with his feelings, his negative emotions, every time that something would happen, because he was such a conflict avoider, what he would do is he'd push that feeling. It's like a tennis ball that he'd push underwater. And then the next event that would sting him, he would take that tennis ball, he'd push it underwater, and the next one would take a tennis ball. And he said eventually he had thousands of tennis balls that he was trying to hold underwater, and he was taking more and more pressure to keep them down there. And there was this incredible desire for all that negative stuff to come out. Well, it almost works the other direction too. I think when you allow yourself to begin to feel those really positive pieces and you don't, you know, you cherish them and you think about them, it's almost like it builds up a pressure back to the other direction. And so, you know, find those places where you enjoy it, appreciate them, kind of savor those moments, and I think you'll find it begins to draw you closer to Him. Certainly think that would be a helpful aspect everything. So here's the next question. Does this mean he doesn't love me? Rick, my spouse, the unfaithful one, now says he loves me and really never loved the other woman, even though he thought he loved her at the time, but now has realized that it was just infatuation for her. But when I ask him why he loves me or what makes him love me, he just draws a blank. The most he'll say is that I'm a sweet, kind person. In the last session, with our local counselor, he told the counselor that he loved me. The counselor asked him, why did he love me? What about me did he love? And my husband just sat there saying nothing. That doesn't sound like love to me. I'm afraid he's just saying he loves me to get me to stay in the marriage, but for the sake of his image and his life and his friends and his family, and his family who don't know about the affair. And he also says now that his AP is not interested in any type of relationship with him. How will I ever know if he really loves me or is just continuing to lie to me or did as he did for all these years of the affair? If he truly loves me, wouldn't he be able to tell other people or me why he loves me? So, you know, part of me kind of wonders with someone like this, back to the previous question about emotional awareness. I think a lot of times, again, people are so incredibly unaware of what goes on internally within them. And, you know, if there can be a series of exercises where they just kind of learn to feel. Certainly learning to see you and appreciate you and see things about you, that's important. But when someone just kind of draws a blank, it also makes me, again, wonder back to the whole awareness aspect. I mean, how much awareness does he really have? And, you know, how do you help him begin to develop something to that end. In self-awareness exercises, and I know I'm giving this to you and it probably would need to go to him, you know, one of the things that I try to do, I actually have it on my cell phone, and my alarm goes off 3 times a day. And in the morning when it goes off, I just write down what I'm feeling at that moment. What is the situation or the perception that I'm kind of thinking about that's creating that feeling? And what can I do to take care of myself right now? It's almost like just I stop and I begin to just kind of concentrate back a little bit of what's happening in my feeler. That sort of self-awareness thing for someone like your husband might be very, very helpful. But it doesn't happen, you know, without, you know, just by happenstance. I mean, I have to do the work, even me, you know, of stopping. Because I mean, I'm not somebody who thinks in terms of feelings very much. So it's been an interesting exercise for me, and I've decided to do it for the next 30 days, of just stopping and thinking, what am I feeling? And because I know, as I've read literature on this, you mean people begin to learn to identify what's going on inside them. And again, with your husband, my thought would be he just needs some help being able to identify some of those things. That would be really useful for him. So next, I'm the unfaithful spouse. I had a partial disclosure about my affair a year ago. We went to EMS, and I realized the damage I'd done. I wasn't completely free of my limerence. My wife forgave me and begged me to return home. The guilt that overpowered me was unbearable. Intrusive thoughts plagued me daily. I relapsed with my affair partner. My wife found out, and now full disclosure has been complete. I've never stopped loving my wife, and I've realized how clouded I was. We haven't had any communication for the past couple of weeks. She told me she needed to let me go. I don't want to lose my wife. I feel like I'm back at square one. Any advice for the next step? You know, the one of the things that you probably heard me say then if you came to EMS was just simply, this isn't about necessarily trying to save your marriage. It's very much about, and the same thing with intimacy, it's very much about being who you were made to be. It's about your own growth. It's about your ability to be authentic and to be real. And, you know, I would get full-blown into individual work. I would get involved in Celebrate Recovery or SAA or SLAA. I begin to do something like Discovery or Breakthrough, something where you can begin to focus on who you are, just becoming, you know, you becoming the person of integrity that you want to be, ultimately the man that you would like to be, someone that you can look in the mirror and know who you are. I would continue to pray for your wife. I wouldn't try to force her. I would certainly try to support her. You certainly can express your opinions to her. But, you know, for someone like that, it's going to really be consistency over time and her seeing something radically different in you. I suspect it would take a very long time. So you're going to have to be committed to that. Well, again, you can't do it for her. And, you know, I know in my own recovery, I did not do what I did for the sake of saving my marriage. I was very clear with Stephanie about that. You know, I just knew that I was to do the things I had done. I was finally convinced there was something seriously wrong with me. And apart from, you know, the grace of God, you know, I didn't know how it ever kind of moved beyond that. And so I just began listening and trying to, you know, what would it look like to be a man of character? I mean, I knew that character development was fixing to be really an important part of my life and walking with God and my faith, and because I was convinced of what I couldn't do anymore. And I knew that if there wasn't a power, if there wasn't a God bigger than me, if I was it, I was in trouble because I had tried to do the right thing and I had failed. So I would just make that your pursuit, and I would I'd be very, very patient. You know, ultimately, I think for your wife, she almost has to have a revelation from above telling her, you know, that she needs to look at you again. But that comes not because you're pressuring her. That's going to come largely because you're respecting her. And that you're doing this not to impress her, but you're doing this because of your heart's desire to become whole. So I will be praying for you. I hope you can find and, you know, a good counselor or find what you need to be able to move forward. Um, My spouse is the unfaithful. Okay, affair, recovery, and codependency. Okay. My spouse is the unfaithful spouse, and we're both in recovery. I'm focusing on my codependency, and have finally made a couple of new friends. My spouse feels I've not connected with him, which is true, but I'm not doing it intentionally. He made a comment how I'm working so hard on myself with new friends, and he feels alone. Part of me was angry because it felt like he was jealous I was focusing on me and had new friends, and assumes I'm not working on our marriage because I'm not focused on him anymore. We've had much more communication with each other and are resolving conflicts better than ever. I feel he's saying it's not enough and that he's jealous. Should this be normal for our codependent relationship? Why is it easier for me to be close to these new girlfriends? Sometimes I'm with my spouse and feel I have nothing to talk about. We're really trying to love each other and heal, but sometimes we get stuck in this cycle where we keep missing each other's hearts. Second, I learned that one of my friends, who is also our nanny, has a similar history of sexually acting out as my husband and me. I was very happy we were able to connect on this issue. We're both relying on God to work out these areas of our life, but I felt afraid. She has a key to our house and is wounded in similar ways as my husband and me. I want to be friends. We do set boundaries. My spouse is never to come home with her alone. She and her boyfriend also have similar boundaries of not spending time alone with anyone of the opposite sex. Do you think it's safe to be with friends with her, or am I being naive? We both have really opened up to each other and are really seeking God in our lives. I feel so scared because my spouse has an addiction, sexual addiction, but he's in recovery too. People that are in recovery, if you think about it, sometimes it's hard to be in a world where there's nothing out there. The trouble is not in the trouble. The trouble is kind of in the heart's attitude toward the trouble. And it's my naivete, my inability to accept or to set up really, really good boundaries. If you remember those suds, seemingly unimportant decisions, if you're able to keep it in the light, you and your friend, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think drawing good boundaries between your husband having really good boundaries with that and the two of you being able to be honest and open and talking about it, I certainly think that is something you ought to be able to handle. But it's something you need to be able to talk about and keep in front of the two of you. If it comes to the place where he finds that he's attracted to her, or you have way too much fear about it, I mean, at that point you just say, it's not healthy. But if it's something where he's not really attracted to her, they're not spending time together, and y'all are keeping safe and good boundaries with the situation, you may find that it's a real blessing. You can be a support to her, and she can be a support to you. You may learn things. You may be able to help each other grow. It's having authentic and real relationships is a blessing in this life. And just because someone has had problems doesn't make them a risk. Now, again, life is full of risk. The person's not the problem. A lot of times the bigger problem is the denial that's associated with the whole situation. And if you're not in denial and y'all are actually addressing things, I would think there's always the possibility that it could be something that was healthy. So hopefully that helps a little bit. That whole codependency thing, the other thing I would just say with your husband and your friends, it is much easier to be intimate with good friends than it is to be intimate with my mate of many years, partially because the intimacy that happens with my mate, it's far more about differences, and that's where the individuation begins to come from. that conflict intimacy, as I've mentioned earlier. If we're not doing that, it's really hard. How do we kind of be together? If we know that we're not quite the same, what do we do with that? And that's a growing process. It doesn't happen overnight. So that's why we go to meetings and we continue to be more aware, and we talk and we share what we're learning, and we just learn to be open and authentic. And over time, we begin growing. We go to a whole other stage where it's not about having to be the same or even resolving the conflict. It's about being able to live at peace with each other, even when we're different, but having an amazing amount of respect for the other person's position and who they are, and still being able to maintain our own position and who God made us to be. So, next question. I'm the unfaithful spouse. My wife is the hurt spouse. Our D-Day was a little over a year ago. God's done a lot in our recovery over the last year, and I can honestly say I'm a different man, and my wife has said that as well. My wife is a different woman also. It's been an incredibly difficult and painful, but and by far the most difficult thing we've ever done, and yet God has done some amazing things through it. One of the challenges we face is that my wife is influenced by the opinions of others and begins to doubt herself. Specifically, she's had a lot of encouragement about my recovery. Our mentor couple has been very encouraging, and our counselor has been very encouraging, and you've been encouraging as well. She's received the message that I've changed and become a safe person, and she's said it herself. However, the husband of one of the long-term friends told her about a week after discovery that she should divorce me. He said that these things never turn out good and that the only solution is to divorce me. To complicate things, this person is a professor, a professional counselor. She's seen the foolishness of what he said, but it still comes back to haunt her, and she begins to second-guess herself and believes that she's being foolish and staying with me. She will sometimes go south, and we can often trace it back to this. I try to listen and understand when she goes south. I know she needs to see from me a consistent track record over time that maybe, hopefully, that overrides the feeling she has from this comment made a year or so ago. We're not really in relationship with this couple anymore, so there are no fresh statements or judgments from them, just this old one. Is there anything else I can do to help her? Is there anything she can do? Thank you ever so much. You know, my first comment is, and as you know this already, if it wasn't something he said, I'm sure it's something that she would probably have read in the media. There are lots of reasons that we get frightened in this whole recovery process. It is really difficult. And if you're only just a year out, I would say that you're still not at the 18-month point. And so there's enough pain that those reminders will still, the reminders of what he said, can still trigger the fear that was created probably during the affair. And when that emotional flood begins to occur, you know, again, those emotions create a motion, a desire for us to do something and to run away. And, you know, until the pain fully subsides, and she's still a ways from that pain subsiding, she's probably going to have that battle at times, because it doesn't take much of a reminder to trigger that emotional flood. Even though it may not be as intense now as it was a year ago, if you're just over a year, she's still going to be, certainly because of those reminders, reliving a lot of things during this, you know, next 6 months as things slowly begin to cool down within her and the wound continues to heal. I think that assuring her, giving her assurance every day, what your heart's desire is, I think validating her feelings, saying, you know, I certainly understand why you're afraid. I certainly understand at times why you feel like you don't trust me, in all honesty. You know, I don't want to ever come to the place that I trust me, because that would make me unsafe for you. And I want to stay at a place where I can be safe. Continuing to process with other people mentors who have already walked this walk, I think is huge. And her being able to, you know, kind of keep her eyes fixed on things above, not on things below. It's really an honor, I think, to be able to be one of those people, to be able to say, look at what God can do, and to kind of be one of the billboards that can show just the amazing journey that you've come through. I, you know, am glad that you're not hanging around with, you know, people who don't understand how this works. You know, I'd almost like to talk to the other counselor and kind of see where they got that opinion to begin with. You know, I think sometimes it's either going to be there's got to be a personal experience, I would think, there somewhere, because maybe they just have never seen something different. But again, what I would say is be patient, continuing to talk with people who have worked through this thing, being with other people in recovery. That's going to be the best thing for her. And you giving her that assurance every day, just tell her, you know, today it's my heart's desire to love you and just to walk in faithfulness with you and to walk with God. And when she hears that day after day, and every day when you tell her that, and tell her every day you appreciate the fact that she stayed with you, then at least it makes those difficult times that she goes through, the painful times, at least she knows that you don't take that for granted and you appreciate it. So with that, we are out of time today. I want to thank everybody who submitted questions. I know there are still a few left, but we got through the vast majority of them today. Maybe Aaron can sit there and pass them over. So hope you guys had a good week, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Bye-bye.